Big Show Thursday style, March 23rd, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We took a look at a proposed bill that would eliminate Connecticut's so-called sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Brookfield GOP State Senator Steve Harding dropped by to talk about a key environmental regulation bill being debated at the state capitol. Economic analyst Dr. Nikolai Wenzel joined us to discuss President Biden's proposed budget. So how much do you generally tip your waiter, your waitress, your server? What can they call them again today? Are there any more modern post-2000 names we give to people who bring us food and drink? Let's see. Waiter, waitress, server, serve staff, wait staff. Have I covered them all? I think I have. Your waiter or waitress. I think waitress now technically is sexist, by the way. It's for the same reason you don't really hear the word actress anymore, a female actor. They say they have, they prefer female actors, male and female actors. You don't have actor and actress, and I don't think you have waitress anymore. Now, excuse me, and I'm a little bit up there now in years, so if I slip and I say, waitress, please, I'm not being sexist, I'm not being misogynistic, you know, been around for a few years, so those old habits are hard to break. It's a hard habit to break, like Chicago sang all those years ago. But when you tip, how well do you tip? I generally do between 15 and 20%. I try to do 20%. It's just, I just like it. I can figure it out easy. Oh, it's a $34 bill. So 10%, $3.40. Double that, $6.80. There you go. $7 tip. There you go. Paulie adds 7 to that $34 tab. For me and a friend, or my son and I, or whomever I'm dining with, and you go $34 to $41. Now, why did I do that? Why did I add that? Why did I go as high as 20%? I know some people go, if they're well-heeled and it's a smaller meal, they'll go 25%, but I digress. The general thing people tip is they tip 10, 15, 20%. I go 20. And why do people go as high as 20? Why do most people tip, T-I-P, to ensure promptness? Why do people tip? Well, they like the service. They know that server, that wait staff person, waitress, waiter. And they know, many people know, some don't. But many people know that Connecticut has what is called in several areas a sub-minimum wage. In Connecticut, where our regular minimum wage this June will go to $15 an hour, right? The sub-minimum wage is a hair under $6.50 an hour here. So even though come this June, at $15 an hour, you can earn at a minimum wage job now over $30,000 a year, which is good, I think. I think the minimum wage was a little too ridiculously low for years, but that's a cost that had to be absorbed by businesses, and they're doing it. They're either doing it or they're passing the cost on to the customers. Anyway, so Connecticut has what's called a sub-minimum wage. A lot of people don't know that. I do, a lot of people do, and that's why that waiter, that wait staff person, that waitress, whatever, that's bringing you your slop on a plate. I'm sorry. But bringing you what you desire to, chow down on. Because people know that person is probably, now not definitely, but probably making the sub-minimum wage, which can be as low as, the base floor. The floor on that wage, $6.38 an hour. I assume some restaurant owners maybe make it $7 or $8 an hour. But the idea is that it's legal to pay somebody who is serving you because they get tips. chips have become ingrained in American society. It's not that way in a lot of cultures. I'm reading around the world where you do have cultures that do not tip for whatever reason. That's deep sociology and you know, country study that we won't go into here. But the bottom line is Connecticut had a sub-minimum wage, and generally people felt okay with it. I mean, I'm sure there were some complaints. But a lot of the people I know that were involved in, and that were and are involved in the restaurant business, the bar business, generally abided by it. And they said generally their servers were happy. Now, the restaurant business is a very competitive business. This is a fact that I've been told numerous times by people in the business and folks at the Connecticut Restaurant Association. 80% of all restaurants will eventually fail. I know it sounds like a high number, and it is. 80%, 8 out of 10 restaurants in your city or town are going to eventually fail. Doesn't mean they're going to fail tomorrow. Doesn't mean they're going to fail next week. But eventually is eventually. How many times, for example, have we driven by a spot in our city or town, and we look up and we say, "What? Wait a minute?" Because like we can tell there's no cars, the lights are off, and you go pull up due to unforeseen circumstances. We are closed for the time being. We hope to reopen, but if not, we thank all our loyal customers, blah, 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 blah. So even places that you look at and say, wow, it looks busy there almost every night, it's a high-cost business. So what the sub-minimum wage did for these businesses was to lower labor rates enough to help them make a decent margin and still draw good staff members who didn't mind working for a lower hourly wage because there was a good clientele there, right? You hear that word? Yeah, my son or daughter worked there. Man, he or she made big money there. The tips, that's a good clientele there. Well, apparently that's going to change, or has the capacity to change. And if you work in the wait industry, if you are a server, if you are a waiter, a waitress, if your son or grandson or niece or nephew or granddaughter or grandson, if they are a waitstaff person and they say, hey, I make pretty good money at that place, I make a lower minimum wage, but I make good tips, especially Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, Sunday during football. Man, I can make $200-$300 a shift. Well, guess what? That may come to an end. That may come to an end. Now, why is it going to come to an end? Because some of the, what a surprise, fill in the blank here, some of the left-leaning members of the Connecticut General Assembly, some Democrats there, and I'll give you the names of who the co-sponsors are of this bill, don't like the fact that there are some people making a sub-minimum wage here in the state. So basically, they want to get rid of that sub-minimum wage, which I guess has been working in the state here for years and years and years, much to the chagrin of restaurant owners who are now going to have to pay. Some say they're going to have to pay more here. Now, some say they were already compensating some of these waiters and waitresses. If even with tips, they weren't up to the regular minimum wage. But the General Assembly here, you know, to me, is setting foot here in something that does this need to be fixed? Was there a screaming outcry that this was a burning consideration here in the state? Or is that, again, folks, what did I tell you? Once we got aft by the 2022 election cycle and we turned a corner and we go up the other side of the street now and we made that hairpin turn from 2022 to 2023, all the taxes, all the fees, all this, that, and the other, all the greasy, dirty stuff was going to come. Remember, in the even years, 2018, 2020, 2022, the General Assembly generally behaves itself. It doesn't do dumb things. It doesn't look to squeeze every single dime or cent out of you and me. They do that in the odd years because they know and they think you'll forget. And most of the time, you will. So we'll come back and talk about this. Why might people be tipping a little bit less in the future? Will you be tipping less at your favorite eatery or drinkery? Will you be giving or tipping less because now you know your server is making more an hour? Now, many of you might say no. I'm going to tip what I always was tipping, but, you know, there's always the capacity, the human condition. Yeah, I used to tip 20%, but they don't need it anymore. I'll outline that, give you the bill name. I'll give you the sponsors of this bill, who you may want to contact if you are a server, and say, what are you doing to me? Traffic and weather together right here, right now on WICC. So the Labor and Public Services Committee at the General Assembly, which is made up of, you know, majority Democrats, of course, looking to turn the screws again on restaurants and bars. And if you don't believe me, read the story here. They have voted to eliminate a policy here, or eliminate the ability of businesses that have wait staff or serve staff to charge a lower wage, a sub-minimum wage that people make if they make tips too, right? How many people have we known? Maybe you did it too. As a young person, maybe you may be doing it now. But they, you know, for years we have known, we have tipped, some of us better than others, knowing that, you know, wait staff, waiters, waitresses, they make a lower wage. So we're like, hey, they're making a few dollars less than the minimum. Let's give them good tips. Well, for some unknown reason that I can figure out, the majority Democrats in Hartford have said, no, this is not a good idea. Now, there's no word that they got any sort of incredible complaints about this, but this is just catering and kowtowing again to the labor left. This is out of the Connecticut News Junkie. The Public Employees Committee in Labor advanced a proposal Tuesday, 2 days ago, that would eliminate Connecticut's tip credit. Now, that's a long-standing policy allowing restaurants to pay a sub-minimum wage with the understanding that servers will make up the difference in tips. Right? And if they didn't make it up, then the business owner stepped in and made it so. The panel approved the bill on an 8-4 partisan vote, a Democrats for Republicans, during its final meeting to pass its own proposals. The legislation removes from state law the sub-minimum wage often received by servers, bartenders, and some hotel staff, and requires their employers to pay them at least minimum wage. In Connecticut, the sub-minimum could be as little as $6.38 an hour, while the regular minimum is $14 and $15 an hour. Now, here's it. Why are we doing this? Have there been mass complaints that workers were getting shortchanged? Maybe there have been. I haven't heard it. Or is this just kissing the rear end of the labor movement? Because, again, we're in the odd years. In the odd years, the majority in Hartford looks to screw people. Democratic proponents of the bill said little during Tuesday's meeting. What a shock. While several Republican lawmakers articulated concerns the bill would hurt restaurants and their staff, the change, they said, was unnecessary because, now get this, folks, listen to me carefully. Listen to me carefully. And if you don't believe me, you can research it yourself. State law already requires employers to compensate staff if they are notified that tips failed to put that employee over the minimum wage threshold. You understand? So they're working for a lower wage, but if they're not making enough in tips, or they had a couple of bad days or whatever, the restaurant or bar owner or hotel owner is required already by state law to compensate those workers and make up the difference. So why is the General Assembly and the majority Democrats, why are they sticking their nose into this? Well, we know why. It looks good. Oh, we love labor. Proponents point to a national movement. I can think of some other movements. Proponents point to a national movement to bring wait staff in line with workers in other industries. What? During a public hearing this month, Saru Jayaraman, president of the national advocacy group One Fair Wage, told the committee that seven states require a minimum wage and the policy had positive benefits for workers, including making them less reliant on customer tips in order to make a living. But Connecticut, oh, I want to pull my hair out. Oh, Connecticut law safeguards that. Connecticut law safeguards that already, does it not? The bill now goes on to the state Senate for consideration. This, and again, this might not affect you and I, but I'm telling you this. There will be people out there who will say, I don't have to tip her as much. I've known her a long time, but you know, I was tipping her because she was making a lower wage. Even if that person may not have known that she'd be compensated to a higher wage per hour if the tips were a little dry that day, that night, or that week. Folks, this is useless. This is nothing more than kissing the rear end of labor, which the Democrats on the Labor Committee always do. Let's stick it to business again with this fee and that fee. So, essentially now, which is already on the books, the notion of a waitstaff person getting a minimum wage is already on the books if they're tipped. Wages did not bring them up to that $15. But I guess now they want to wake up and smile at themselves when they look in the mirror in the morning. It's mind-boggling, mind-numbing. First, though, I want to get another look at something we talked about yesterday that's raised a few eyebrows. It's Raise Bill RB1145 up at the state capitol that if it passed, if you read the bill, it would allow whomever the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Commissioner is, basically allow the General Assembly to do an end run here and let that person, him or her, presently or in the future, you know, implement some pretty serious economic policies that could cost you and I money. It hasn't been voted on yet, from what I understand, but to fill us in on that, we welcome to the program here for the first time, I believe, Brookfield Republican State Senator Steve Harding is with us. Hey, Steve, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Thank you for having me and looking forward to having a discussion about this.
Yes. Yeah, so where does this...
One of the worst bills I've seen in the Environment Committee.
Yeah. Where does this stand right now, Steve? I saw a news release from an interest group earlier today that said, well, now the vote is maybe tomorrow, and I've been told there might be some support for this, maybe softening. What's the latest?
Well, I would hope that it's beginning to soften because, as I said, this is one of the worst bills I've seen in the Environment Committee in many years. And this is also a bill that is unequivocally going to drive up the cost of energy, of products, of really anything that you purchase in the state of Connecticut. It could have significant direct or indirect impacts of driving up the cost. Particularly with energy costs here in the state of Connecticut, and so I'm not sure if support for the bill is softening. I think that if you read it and you really digest what it will do, that support absolutely should soften, in my opinion. But I know with that almost absolute certainty, there's going to be a vote on this tomorrow. There's some small changes here and there to the bill, but nothing significant. Really, the bill. What I expect to be voted on tomorrow has these drastic, significant negative provisions. As I said, that will just drive up energy costs to uncertain and very high levels here in the state.
And Steve, the thing that concerns me and should concern, I think, our listeners here and a lot of people around the state, that, yeah, you want to obviously debate environmental policy. There are things we should do, we are doing, we may want to do. But from what I understand, this would either eliminate or quash most, if all the debate here, Steve, and give whomever the DEEP commissioner is, either now or in the future, some pretty extensive powers here, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Unfettered ability to cap emissions, to create partnership agreements with other states, not even regional states, but any state in the country that would cap emissions, to levy fees and assessments on certain emissions. Really unfettered ability to do all of that without in the legislature being able to opine. And so, you know, we've had discussions, I know you have, in the past about the governor's executive orders during COVID, and the legislature not having any ability to really run the state, letting one person run a state. I mean, when it comes down to energy and environmental policy and levying fees and call what it is, taxes on businesses and residents here in the state of Connecticut, we're basically levying and ceding that authority through this bill to the current commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection and future commissioners, for that matter. Just from a philosophical standpoint, mm-hmm. outside of the fees, it's wrong. You know, we are voted by our constituents to vote on these issues, as you said, to have a discussion on environmental policy, not to cede our authority to one person within administration that's unelected, for that matter, too.
I highlighted some things I found in the PDF of the bill yesterday, and I had a laugh. You know, Steve, market-based compliance mechanisms. That, Steve, sounds like it's right out of the school of calling a strip joint a gentleman's club. I mean, we kind of know what market-based compliance mechanisms are, right? We're talking taxes and fees.
Exactly right. And so you can call it whatever you want to call it. I mean, this is very, first off, you know, TCI, as you know, was a topic a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was different language for that. Folks were trying to, in the legislature that was promoting the bill, were saying, well, this is not really a tax. It's an assessment. It's market-based in terms of the increased fees. Call what you will. Government is implementing a policy which is going to cost the consumer more money when they utilize an energy source. That's a tax. It doesn't matter what name you may give it, what title you may give it, how direct or indirect it may be. This is going to cost more money and take more money out of the pockets of hardworking residents here in the state of Connecticut. And government is going to be implementing the policy in which does that. In my eyes, and I think in many other logical individuals' eyes, this is nothing more than a tax. And I think that is one of the aspects of the bill that I disagree with the most, at a time when we are facing record inflation across the board, and particularly record rates in terms of energy rates here in the state of Connecticut at this time, to implement something that is just going to do nothing but drive up the cost for consumers, and allowing one particular person to implement policies to do that. Is a very bad policy at a very bad time.
And finally, Steve, just because this may clear the committee tomorrow and move ahead doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a floor vote on this. I mean, this thing, even if it clears that hurdle tomorrow, the people could still speak up and stop this, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I certainly encourage individuals, which should be all hardworking individuals in the state of Connecticut that are concerned about the cost of energy rates or cost of really anything here in the state, for those individuals to express their concerns to their legislators if this bill moves forward. And unfortunately, I do expect it to move forward out of committee tomorrow. I'll certainly be voting no to oppose it, but I do expect it to move forward tomorrow. But as you mentioned, this is only one step in the process. I will mention it's a significant step that getting a bill a public hearing and then having that bill voted out of committee is a significant step, but there still would be a Senate vote, a House vote, and then the governor would have to ultimately sign it into law. That's still remaining on the bill, even if it gets out of committee tomorrow. So there is still time to express your concerns to your individual legislators about what this bill will do to drive up costs here in the state of Connecticut for small businesses and residents alike.
All right, Steve, thank you. Republican State Senator Stephen Harding, primarily the Brookfield Danbury area. Steve, thank you. We appreciate it. Take care, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for highlighting this issue. Really appreciate the time.
All right, thanks. Steve Hardy there, Steve Harding, rather. H-A-R-D-I-N-G, primarily state senate district encompassing areas around Danbury, Brookfield, that whole part of the state there. So again, this is RB 1145, I believe, raised bill 1145, that would allow whomever the commissioner of DEEP is, D-E-E-P, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. It would sidestep, it would allow the commissioner, whomever that may be in the future, Democrat or Republican, it would allow the commissioner of DEEP to sidestep the legislative process, allowing the General Assembly, the House and Senate, to pull a full Pontius Pilate. Let's go a little biblical for you, shall we? And wash their hands of having to vote on things like making environmental agreements that would affect Connecticut residents with Canadian provinces. Eh? What's going on there, eh? How's it going there? We signed that their thing with Connecticut, eh? Did you read it? No, I didn't either. I mean, it's like a Bob and Doug bit. Why are we doing that? So we'll keep you updated with that. How's it going, E? But let's spend about 10, 15 minutes here talking budget, talking taxes here. How's the U.S. economy? Is it really good? Is it meds in the middle? What's up with all this inflation? Are things going to get better? Should you refi? Should you not refi? I like to have a variety of economic voices on this show, both local and national. Joining us right now, Dr. Nikolai Wenzel. He's an associate research faculty member for the American Institute for Economic Research. And Dr. Wenzel has a distinguished resume of academics and analysis of the economy over the years. Dr. Wenzel, hi, it's Paul at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time. We appreciate it. Well, good, bad, in the middle? Should we be worried, moderately worried, not worried? What do we see with the American economy and the Biden budget and all this stuff that's going to be yelled and screamed about on both sides? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a natural optimist, so I'm going to stay optimistic about the economy, but I have to say I'm not terribly excited and pretty pessimistic about the proposed Biden budget.
What is it? First of all, give us an outline, Dr. Wenzel, about what is it, spending, taxes, any cuts there? What are the two or three things that stick out to you from your line of thinking and analysis here?
Well, the first thing is it's pretty big. It proposes almost $7 trillion, so $6.8 trillion of federal spending. And it's also proposing to increase new taxes by a gross amount of $4.7 trillion. There will be a few credits and offsets, but basically it's a massive proposed tax increase. And my two biggest problems with it are, first, that the rhetoric around it is rather disingenuous. And the second one is that it's going to hurt American competitiveness and possibly hurt the economy if it were to pass.
Now, is that, Dr. Wenzel, because there's just too much money soaked up by taxes and kind of not, you know, circulating in the engine block and the crankcase to keep the economy humming? Is that the main reason?
Well, part of it is, before COVID, federal spending stood at about 20% of GDP, mm-hmm. and then it peaked at about 30% of GDP during the Trump and Biden administrations with the COVID relief acts, which were then soaked up by the Federal Reserve and monetized, but that's a different story. And now we're back down, if I may say so, to 25% of GDP proposed. That's a quarter of the economy run by the federal government. That's not in the hands of entrepreneurs, not in the hands of CEOs, but it's run by bureaucrats in Washington.
Knowing that we need a certain amount of federal spending, Dr. Wenzel, what is there an ideal number? Is there kind of a target number where you and other economists and people that analyze this stuff could say, okay, if we were down around here, things would be best? Is that calculable or not?
Well, I'm going to answer your question in a slightly different way, if I can.
Sure.
And I'm going to go back to the U.S. Constitution. I'm going to look at Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And I know it's quaint these days to talk about the Constitution, but the Constitution tells us what the federal government's allowed to do. And there's about a dozen functions. So without putting a number on it quite yet, I would say let's start by having a federal government that does what it's allowed to do under the Constitution, under Article 1, Section 8, the courts, defense, a few other functions, and not try to have its hand in everything, especially things like industrial policy, beefing up infrastructure, technology, trying to do a little bit of everything with the notion that bureaucrats in Washington can do a better job than entrepreneurs and CEOs of companies.
Getting a perspective on the latest Biden budget, Dr. Nikolai Wenzel, for a few more moments, an associate research faculty member of the American Institute for Economic Research. Dr. Wenzel, this proposed tax, this billionaire's tax, which we hear about this, it's kind of a merry-go-round that keeps coming around and around and around. Even if we did this, would any of that be consequential enough in a multi-trillion dollar budget to even make a difference or not? What are your thoughts on this billionaire tax, or is it just kind of an index card thing that sounds good?
Well, it's certainly political. There's something, first of all, very disingenuous about it. The Biden administration keeps talking about having the wealthy Americans pay their fair share, but as things stand, the top 1% of taxpayers currently pay about 42% of federal revenue, and the top 10% pay about 74%. So the wealthiest of Americans are already paying what I would consider to be more than their fair share. And the biggest problem is overall increasing taxes, the proposed tax on billionaires, the proposed increased tax on capital gains, the proposed increase in the marginal income tax rate to almost 40%, proposed increase in the corporate tax rate, all of that, put all that together, and that's putting a brake on American competitiveness and putting a brake on the economy.
You know, Dr. Wenzel, we hear every year, you know, a few months after tax day. So you figure if tax day is around April 15th, I think it's the 18th this year. So we will probably hear, what, May, June, July, maybe in August or September, hey, we've collected, or the IRS registered and collected a record amount of taxes every year. And we get that record amount every year, but yet we still have our economic problems.
Well, that's because the spending is increasing also. And that brings me to another disingenuous thing about the budget that I find to be particularly interesting. The Biden administration claims that the budget will cut the deficit by nearly $3 trillion. And the thing to keep in mind is the deficit is the annual difference between spending and tax revenue. Mm-hmm. What we really care about is the national debt, which is at about $32 trillion. So what the Biden administration is saying is that the budget will increase the national debt, but at a slightly lower rate. And that reminds me of the fact that, wait, over the past decade or so, I've lost about 100 pounds and gained about 99 pounds. Well, we don't care about the annual problem. What we care about is the net problem, putting a drag on the economy, and it's all that big spending coming from Washington, D.C.
If the president, Mr. Biden, or any president, Dr. Wenzel, said to you, hey, Doc, what do we do about Medicare and Social Security? Because every time I bring it up in a speech, I get screamed at from the left and screamed at from the right. What would you tell an American president about that?
Well, I would say, unfortunately, look at the news at what's going on in Europe. There are riots in Paris right now over a retirement account crisis. The national government in France tried to increase increased the retirement age, and people weren't happy. So in many ways, Europe is the canary in the coal mine for the U.S. It's politically problematic, but we're going to have to find as a country a different way of doing things, and the current system does not work. I'm always a fan of privatization. I'm always a fan of maybe a Chilean-style system where there's portability. And the current system simply will not work, but politicians love to kick the can down the road.
They certainly do. And when you talk about privatization, I read that there have been these studies, and there were a couple of studies done in some towns years ago about one town or one area of folks took their Social Security contributions at a young age, and instead of them being held by the Social Security Administration and the government, they were allowed to have private investment in this whole thing. And I think it was something in the end where they had three or four times the amount of, you know, a monthly benefit that somebody was getting on this. So, I mean, there have been experiments about this, right, in the past?
Certainly there have been experiments. And then the IRA and the Roth IRA are a move in the right direction. But I think also the problem was, for political reasons, when Social Security was sold to Americans, it had to be sold to everybody. And one great step would be to privatize the system and let people invest in the stock market and bond markets with positive rates of return as opposed to zero or negative with Social Security. And then you could conceivably mop up with a means-tested support program for a small percentage of Americans instead of having a blanket program that doesn't work for anybody.
Boy, you mentioned means test, though, Dr. Wenzel, and I have mentioned that on this show, and maybe you don't start it right away. I mean, I've been hearing people saying, well, for the new people getting into the system, but, you know, the minute I've ever mentioned, not that I'm for it, right, but I just want to put it out there, how about a means test? Oh, my God, my phone lines melt down. I paid into it. Why am I going to get less? And they kind of have a point, right? Should we look at something, though, heading out here for younger folks, right?
Well, there could be some sort of a breakdown by age, and I've seen different proposals. You could break it down into, say, 20 to 35, 35 to 50 or so, and then leave it for people. There are ways of doing that. I'm 49, and I would gladly opt out of Social Security payments for the next 10 years in exchange. No payments, no benefits, because I can do better over 10 years in the private market than the government can in investing it for me. So there are ways of working around that, certainly.
The website is the American Institute for Economic Research, AIER.org, AIER.org. Good chat with Dr. Nikolai Wenzel. Dr. Wenzel, thanks. We appreciate it. Take care, and we surely will chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Wenzel. Dr. Nikolai Wenzel, if you're into that sort of stuff where you like to read about the economy and things of that nature, AIER, from a conservative point of view, the American Institute for Economic Research. Or is it research? Is it the Caribbean or the Caribbean? I don't know. People ask. People want to know.